This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and we start today on Capitol Hill, where change is on the horizon. Yesterday, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and other members of the Democratic House leadership announced they were stepping back from those positions. And today, in response, Massachusetts Congresswoman Catherine Clark says she will seek to become the number two Democrat in leadership. All of that comes as Republicans have taken back control of the House while Democrats have held power in the Senate. So there's a lot going on, and there's a lot underneath that. Here to talk about what all of this change could mean here in Massachusetts, Congresswoman Lori Trahan, who represents the state's 3rd congressional district. Congresswoman, welcome back.
Thank you for having me, Tiziana.
So I want to ask you sort of, let's put all the politics aside for a minute. Nancy Pelosi announces yesterday she's going to step down as, you know, by all accounts, a groundbreaking Speaker of the House of Representatives. And then your colleague, Catherine Clark, today announces that she's going to step forward to really break some ground herself as a colleague of Catherine Clark, as a woman in the Democratic Party. How are you feeling about all of this today?
I'm extremely excited. I mean, first, as much of those two events are linked, I think I'll start first by just saying, I was sitting on the floor of the House yesterday when Speaker Pelosi started speaking, and you could have heard a pin drop in the chamber. I mean, I think people realize the significance of the moment, this remarkable woman who has been so crucial in the leadership of our nation over the past two decades, announcing that she wouldn't seek to remain in leadership next year. And it was emotional, it was riveting, and it was heartwarming. I have to say, Republicans in the chamber were there with us feeling the same thing. And that really stood out to me because above the politics, the legislative battles, and the headlines, Speaker Pelosi is known for how much she truly cares about other people and how effective she's been leading our caucus and our country. So every time, I see her, she asks me about my two young girls, if a member's spouse is sick, and she remembers to ask how they're doing and remarks about how she's keeping them in her prayers. And it's just remarkable, something that we all aspire to in terms of hitting that bar of excellence. In my opinion, she's the single most effective speaker we've had in the history of the House of Representatives. And, that's saying something when we're here in Massachusetts, the home of incredible speakers like Tip O'Neill and John McCormick. But you just look at her track record, passing the Affordable Care Act, the Dodd-Frank banking regulations after the 2009 financial crisis, the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act. Those alone would be lifetime achievements for most people. But that's really just scratching the surface when you realize that with a single-digit majority over the past 2 years, she steered us through some of the most consequential pieces of legislation in generations. The single largest investment to combat the climate crisis, the single largest investment in rebuilding our infrastructure, empowering Medicare to negotiate the prescription drug prices and gun safety legislation for the first time in over 20 years. So, as you know, our caucus ranges in ideology, and the fact that we were able to get all of that done in less than 2 years is just really a testament to the speaker and the way she leads.
So now we are in this very different moment, right? So the speaker who has really sort of set the tone in the role for the Democratic Party for the last generation is stepping back from leadership, staying in Congress, and we'll pick that up a little bit later. And now here comes Catherine Clark, who has been up in leadership, right, but is now vying for a role that no one in Massachusetts, has been in the 21st century. You know her well. She has been called everything from the silent assassin to also a kind, caring woman. What do you think that she can bring into the House? And here's what I want to talk about, Congresswoman Trahan, that will lead everyone in the House of Representatives, because clearly those who care less about Democrat and Republican, what they care about right now is a functioning House of Representatives.
You're absolutely right. I mean, I think the speaker said it best when she was on the floor yesterday, that the hour has come for a new generation to lead the Democratic caucus. I couldn't be happier to see Assistant Speaker Clark rise to the number two position in the Democratic caucus. I mean, she's a friend, a mentor to me it never ceases to amaze me how hard she works, not just for her district and our Commonwealth, but for the country. And what's especially exciting is what her new role as whip will mean for Massachusetts. I mean, our state hasn't had a representative this high up in the House since Tip O'Neill was Speaker. And we know that positions us for even greater things in the years ahead. But you're right. She has a unique capability of bringing people together. She is so effective. She has been so effective in, you know, bringing people together on these, you know, generational pieces of legislation. She understands. She's traveled to districts all over the country. She has been incredibly effective in recruiting great members and a new generation of leaders. And she understands intimately well the challenges that they face at home, what they need to deliver, and how that needs to be communicated to our caucus, but also on the House floor. So I'm really excited about her candidacy. I am all in terms of helping her get there. But in truth, she's been laying the groundwork for this for quite some time. And even her relationship to the Speaker has prepared her for this next role.
We're speaking with Congresswoman Lori Trahan of the 3rd District about changes in House leadership, the move by Congresswoman Catherine Clark to try to ascend to whip for the Democratic Party. There's a lot here. I want to go into a different space now, Congresswoman Trahan, and I'm actually thinking about a conversation I had with former New York Times and Washington Post journalist Margaret Sullivan here at WBUR City Space on Wednesday night, where she talked about internet trolls in social media and how, as a woman in journalism, there was a uniquely aggressive and sexualized way that people went after her because she was a woman. And I'm thinking about Nancy Pelosi, who in reporting on All Things Considered yesterday on NPR, it was reported that she said actually she's staying in Congress in part because her husband was attacked in their home with this aggressive attack that appears to have been politically motivated. We're talking about Catherine Clark ascending to a place in leadership as a woman that no one in Massachusetts has done in the 21st century in a time when women are particularly at risk by trolls, aggression, violence, doxing, et cetera. How do you think about that as a woman in Congress in this moment? And how do we think about that for any woman in a leadership position in our Congress right now?
It's a great question, Tiziana. You know, there's no question that women have to overcome more challenges, not just in sort of keeping their focus, but also from, you know, outside attacks. And social media definitely exacerbates all of that. I mean, it was, you know, the Speaker would often say, you know, let them attack me. We have to remain clear-eyed and focused on the work ahead. And she knew that she had to stay focused as the leader of our party. And Catherine knows that as well. There are bad forces at play. There's misinformation, there's disinformation, and then there's just the ugly targeting that happens, you know, in whether it's in campaign season or it's while we're trying to get our agenda across the line. And I think, you know, with more women, you know, today, I mean, I remember when, you know, the speaker commented yesterday that, you know, when she took office, there were only 12 Democratic women in the House 35 years ago. I remember those days as a young staffer on the Hill. The gravity of the fact that we are at more than 90 members today, it is not lost on me how far we've come in that time. And it is because of the work that Speaker Pelosi did and the path that she charted and the baton that Assistant Speaker Clark is going, you know, to now take and run with. And I think as women together, we often convene to share how we deal with those, you know, those challenges that are unique to us and this time of incredible division in our country. But I think that we've proven time and time again that, you know, women are not only up for the task, but we have this the speaker who's really going to go down in history as the most effective, and I think we draw our motivation and our inspiration from that.
Last question for you: despite the trolling that we've just been talking about here in Massachusetts, lots of firsts just happening. For example, first female elected governor in Maura Healey, first open lesbian governor, first woman of color in the AG role with Andrea Campbell, a number of women in our congressional delegation, a woman senator. Are you proud of where Massachusetts is right now?
I couldn't be prouder. I mean, of course, on election night, the historic results that we had in our state, just not lost on me as the mother of two young girls. Even my mom and I were on the phone because it's historic, and it just sets a new floor for women running for office and achieving those leadership roles across our state. And so I couldn't be prouder of you know, Governor-elect Healey, Lieutenant Governor-elect Kim Driscoll, AG-elect Andrea, and even Diana DeZoglio, our new auditor. I mean, it was just a fabulous night, and one that we really are going to anchor to, so that we make sure that that's just the start. I think right now, you know, with Assistant Speaker Clark becoming the whip, it really does show that the sky is the limit for women in Massachusetts politics.
All right, Congresswoman Lori Trahan, representing the state's 3rd Congressional District, always appreciate it when you can join us. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We are back with another edition of Set in Boston, where we look at movies based on or made in Boston with local film critics. Last time we covered the quintessential Boston crime movie, The Friends of Eddie Coyle. And today, by listener vote, the film we'll discuss is Ben Affleck's 2010 crime thriller, The Town.
There are over 300 bank robberies in Boston every year. Most of these professionals live in a 1 square mile neighborhood called Charlestown.
Thank you, John Hamm, who serves as the FBI foil in this film about cops and robbers. And here to break down The Town are film critics Ty Burr and Allie Johnson. Ty is the creator of the Substack e-newsletter Ty Burr's Watchlist, and Allie is a film critic for CambridgeDay.com and editor-in-chief at InBetweenDrafts.com. Ty, welcome back.
Thank you.
Allie, welcome back to you as well.
Thank you for having me.
So last night, my husband and I rewatched The Town. It's probably, I don't know how many times I've seen it, but a lot. Mm-hmm. And it struck me, Allie, how many memes there are in The Town. You know, Jeremy Renner in the police officer outfit, and whose car we going to take, and all these different things. This is a movie with kind of a life of its own, Allie.
Yeah, and I think it's something I didn't completely realize until rewatching it myself. I had seen it years ago when it first came out, and then I watched it again this week, like you. And it is kind of amazing, you know, how much of a film community it built around itself in terms of fans, which I guess just shows you when you put a localized film out there, people in the area are going to be drawn to it.
Oh, and by the way, listen, if you have not seen The Town, first, you didn't do your homework, but second, fair warning, we will spoiler anything we want to in this conversation, so heads up. So Ty, now take us back to 2010 and sort of set the stage of the emergence of this film for us.
Well, this movie was just past the crest, and you could argue that it may have been, you know, the crest of the renewed Boston crime film. It came out after Mystic River. It came out after The Departed, and it came out after Gone Baby Gone, which was Ben Affleck's sort of resurgence. He directed that film. He'd kind of been in the pop culture doghouse before that, and with directing Gone Baby Gone, he sort of reestablished himself as a credible, you know, filmmaker. For the first time, he went on to win an Oscar for Argo. But with Gone Baby Gone, which to my mind is really one of the best neo-Boston crime movies, he sort of set the stage for, as you said, a lot of the memes. With The Town, I think he sort of solidified those memes. To me, it's a movie it's almost the Aristotelian ideal of the Boston crime film, so much so that it feels in places like it's I'm not going to say it's stereotyped or cliched, but it feels like it's working in sort of plot elements that feel like we know them so well. These are stories and characters that are familiar to us by now.
Yeah, so that's a great point. So, Ellie, I'm going to play a little sound here, and I'm going to play it for two reasons. One, because we found out this week that actually, so this is a moment, as a very famous moment from The Town. Jeremy Renner and Ben Affleck are talking to each other in the apartment. One, it turns out on the TV in the background is Friends of Eddie Coyle,
yes,
which you'll be able to hear. Ty, I think you're the one maybe that told us that, or Amanda noticed it. Somebody noticed it. Friends of Eddie Coyle. And then two, I want to talk about the tropes that kind of come forward in this cut as well. So here's Renner and Affleck.
I need your help. I can't tell you what it is. You can never ask me about it later, and we're going to hurt some people.
Whose car are we going to take?
All right, so A, you can totally hear Robert Mitchum.
Absolutely.
Right, from
yes.
Friends of Eddie Coyle, which is just cool, right, the film within the film. But two, that whole friendship between two guys and one drags the other guy down. One guy's trying, I kept thinking of Al Pacino and the third guy, I keep trying to get out and they keep pulling me back in. It felt a little fresher in 2010 than it does in 2022, Allie. It feels tropey now a little bit.
There's a lot about the film to me that is dated now and probably arguably was dated then, especially in how they portrayed their female characters. But I do think the one thing that kind of can stand the test of time is Jeremy Renner and Ben Affleck's brotherhood, so to speak, and the idea that you will follow somebody if you have a shared history, sometimes through thick and thin, even if it's against your own, you know, sense of morality. But I think that's one of those things in revisiting where I am struck by the tropes, and I am struck by how Rebecca Hall's character is just there to be the saint.
And vulnerable.
Mm-hmm. And vulnerable and saintly vulnerable, and there to open Ben Affleck up to this world of possibly being a decent human being. So to have her, and then to have the Blake Lively character, who is the opposite end of that, to have the mother who's out of the picture, it just kind of brought up all these tropes of how not to write women that I thought is really engaging and interesting to kind of revisit now.
So Blake Lively, actually, she was quite much younger then. She was filming Gossip Girl at the time. She did an interview talking with Jake Hamilton about how she worked on her character, makeup for The Town. Here it is.
I would do my makeup the night before and put on a ton of eyeliner. And I talked to the makeup artist to see if, you know, they were okay with this. And I said, because these girls will get ready, they'll go out for the night, they'll put on all the makeup, they'll come home, party so hard, just pass out, get up the next day and just add on more eyeliner. So I was happy with the way I looked.
So, Ty, I'm really struck, based on what Allie was just saying, I was struck by these girls, right? That there's this sense that she was caricaturing something she thought existed,
right,
versus actually playing a woman who is struggling with cocaine and oxy and single motherhood. And as she says one line in the movie, why am I the one that always winds up getting used?
Right. 2 points here. I would compare her performance with Amy Ryan's performance in Gone Baby Gone, a similar character. Amy Ryan, who was Oscar nominated for her performance, is so deeply believable. She has one line, which I cannot repeat here on radio.
Thank you.
That that you think, oh my God, she's really from Boston. And the other thing I want to say about her character.
So so you're saying Blake Lively did not achieve what Amy Ryan achieved?
No. Blake Lively is no Amy Ryan. I will just say that. I also think, in regards to all these characters, this movie really is a throwback to the Warner Brothers movies of the gangster movies of the 30s, and it's fun to play that game. Who would you cast if The Town was made in 1937? Well, you know, Bogart in the Affleck role, James Cagney Jeremy Renner is doing James Cagney in this movie, and very, very well. And yeah, Ida Lupino is going to play the Blake Lively character.
So, Jeremy Renner, let's talk there, because one, when we put out in Twitter, hey, do your homework, watch The Town, join us on Friday for this conversation, immediately the Jeremy Renner stuff started, right? And either people kind of hated what he did with that character or were like, Jeremy Renner is that movie. And Allie, when I watched it, what struck me is we're so used to today Jeremy Renner as Hawkeye, right? Jeremy Renner in Marvel. This felt like Jeremy Renner in The Hurt Locker, mm-hmm. where he won an Oscar and where it was a raw, violent, unveiled performance. So you obviously know where I fall down on Jeremy Renner in The Town. Where do you come down on Jeremy Renner in The Town?
I think he's the reason I probably went as quickly as I did to see it originally was because I had seen The Hurt Locker and I loved it and I loved him. And he still was very good in The Town. And I think he has the best, most tragic scene in the entire film. And it's a throwaway. He leans over to take a sip of a soda before making a really big decision. And that might be the closest to capturing the friends of Eddie Coyle. So I think he's amazing. And I think he shows so much beyond the kind of bad guy veneer that the character's showcasing. I think I remembered him being in it more. So to rewatch it, I was like, he's a huge part of why it succeeds, and they did not utilize him as much as they could have. But I think he is the reason to watch this movie.
So, Ty, you react strongly to the soda reference, which, by the way, it's somebody else's soda.
Yes.
Right? It's just sitting on the ground.
Yes. He just needs that one last moment.
And, you know, I do wonder if that moment was improvised.
Yeah.
It feels real. It feels
it
raw.
Did.
Again, just going back to Cagney, you know, famously, when Cagney made The Public Enemy, he was in the best friend role, and he was so amazing. They switched the roles and made him the lead, like 2 days into filming. I kind of wonder what would have happened if they'd done that here. But nevertheless, he is so believable as a hair trigger best friend. Again, a cliched part that he just absolutely brings to life. And I will point out that his accent's pretty darn flawless. And we can talk about accents in every Boston movie we talk about. I do wonder if Ben Affleck had his accent beaten out of him in Hollywood, because it sounds good, but it sounds a little practiced.
And remember, for everybody, and we're talking about The Town, this is set in Boston. We've got Ali Johnson and Ty Burr here. Ben Affleck is from Cambridge. Affleck is from Cambridge, Ali. But, and I've only been here, you know, several decades now, so I'm not sure.
You're not really from
right.
here.
But I'm with Ty. I actually felt in some ways Jeremy Renner felt more comfortable in his skin than Ben Affleck did.
I think so, too. And controversial opinion, maybe. I think that's just because Jeremy Renner is a really good actor. And I think Ben Affleck sometimes struggles for that level of believability and authenticity, even when he's essentially playing somebody that he might have grown up around.
Yeah.
And he can't recapture it. I think there's too much thought. Like Ty said, with his practice, he's thinking way too much in the moment of how he's supposed to sound.
Although he is a good director.
Yeah.
And I think I will stick up for him as an actor. He's more of a star than an actor, but he's put in some very good performances. And I think actually this is a good Hollywood melodramatic performance. Again, owing a lot to, you know, previous sort of noir heroes. But within that, I think it works just fine.
So, you know, a shout out to Chuck Hogan, whose book Prince of Thieves had already been out. This was past kind of you're saying it's the sort of the definitive or the peak of Boston crime films. We had a bunch of Dennis Lehane. I think there was another Dennis Lehane after that, although I don't remember. Yeah, there was. It was Ben Affleck was in it, as a matter of fact. But there was a moment last night, and producer Amanda Belan said this morning, too, because she rewatched it last night, too, where you're like, really? We're doing this again. You know? When are we going to start telling different stories about Boston?
Yep.
And do you both feel that way about that movie now, or is it a movie that was of its moment in the lexicon, and you just kind of leave it where it is, but hope we stop doing that in favor of something else?
I will actually say, you know what? If you don't mind, I'm going to read the first paragraph of my 2010 review in the Boston Globe when this came out. And first I'll read it, and then I'll say why I read it. And it's the first paragraph. I don't care what anyone outside the greater metropolitan area says. The town takes place in movie Boston rather than the real thing. Movie Boston is a sub-Scorsese landscape of stubbled men walking down mean Suffolk County streets that exists primarily in the minds of good pulp novelists and bad screenwriters. And its authenticity depends far too much on Hollywood actors trying hard to bend their dialogue around non-rhotic speech patterns. To me, this was the Town was the movie. And you know what? I don't dislike The Town. I think it's a perfectly okay movie. But it was the movie where the cliches of the Boston crime film started to ossify. And it leads to that famous Seth Meyers parody Boston movie, if you've seen it online.
Yes.
That The Town, to me, is a little too close to Boston movie to really enjoy.
So, Allie Johnson, I'll turn to you sort of for the last thought here. And I know this is a little bit of an unexpected question, but what would be the fun new trope about Boston that you'd like to see kind of become? Really, we're going to do another movie about this in Boston. What would that be?
I think, you know, honestly, in terms of location and having been one myself, the student-aged population should be, I mean, this is a student city. It's a young, young city. I was here mainly in, you know, my early 20s. And I think to kind of maybe showcase that or even do, you know, a party movie in a university or to just show the struggles of people who work and go to school and just show that energy and capture the real life kind of grind that we're all going through while we're here. I think that would be really fun, relatable, and I think it would offer it up to a lot of new perspectives.
All right. Challenge accepted. I hope the movie-making world out there, and we have a big one in Boston, heard that. That is Allison Johnson. Allie Johnson is the editor-in-chief at InBetweenDrafts.com and film critic at CambridgeDaily.com. Ty Burr is the creator of the Substack e-newsletter, Ty Burr's Watchlist. This was our second set in Boston. There will be more. Watch us in social media to find out what we're all watching next. Allie, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Ty, thanks as always.
Thanks, Tiziana.
What you're hearing right now is part of I Got Lost in His Arms from Annie Get Your Gun, written by composer Irving Berlin. You probably heard and know many of Berlin's, get this, more than 1,000 songs. But do you know really what makes them great? Rob Capello does, and he's coming here to Boston to teach us. Musician, composer, author, Rob's coming back to town this weekend for another edition of his What Makes It Great concerts, brought to you by Celebrity Series of Boston. And this time, the show will take a deep dive into the songbook of Irving Berlin. We caught up with Rob yesterday, and I asked him, why Irving Berlin?
Amazingly enough, Irving Berlin is the most successful composer of the entire American songbook. And I can't imagine anyone who would have been less likely to become the most successful American songbook composer than Irving Berlin. I mean, what an amazing rags to riches story. And also, it seemed to have a particular resonance now. I mean, all the anti-Semitism that's happening right now or that's in the news right now, literally without anti-Semitism, Irving Berlin would never have become the most successful American songbook composer in history, nor would he have ever even been in America if it weren't for anti-Semitism.
So I was going to have us dive right into his song, I Got Lost in His Arms. But I think what we should do, actually, since you've sort of taken us to this place in his history and you've talked about this rags to riches, and I know what you mean. You're not saying that there's a good side to anti-Semitism,
no.
But you're saying that he found grace in the changes he had to make in his life. So just very quickly, Rob, take us through that story.
Yeah. As I say, anti-Semitism is at the heart of the entire story. Born in 1888, Tsarist Russia, leaves home because his home was burned down as part of a wave of anti-Semitic pogroms, comes to America in 1893, arrives at Ellis Island a year after it opens, unbelievably poor, family of eight, lives in a squalid tenement conditions on the Lower East Side with eight family members. Father dies at the age of 13. He leaves home, runs away from home, lives in Bowery Street flop houses at the age of 13, barely earning enough money to survive, selling newspapers on the street, busking, eventually becomes a singing waiter in a Chinatown restaurant, then gets heard eventually by a music publisher, becomes a lyricist, can't play the piano at all, can't read music, teaches himself to play just enough piano to play his own songs, never learns to read or write music in his entire life, has to dictate all his songs to various musical secretaries that he hires throughout his career, can only play the piano in one key, F sharp major, using almost exclusively the black keys of the piano, and somehow with all those handicaps manages to become the most successful songwriter in American history.
And
an incredible story.
It is an incredible story, and all the way to music that you think represents greatness. And you pick I Got Lost in His Arms. We played it in the intro. Why this song? Tell us what makes it great?
You know, I often say there are, and this is a real oversimplification, but I'll stand by it. I often say there are really two kinds of composers. There's the people who are what I call melody composers, who are really driven by melody. And then there are people who are what I call harmony composers, where what first happens is the chords. And the chords are what drive them. The melody gets put on top of them. But there are people who are driven by chords, and there are people who are driven by melodies. And all my life, since the age of three, it's beautiful chords that have been what move me in music. And this has the most beautiful chords and the most incredible harmony of any Irving Berlin song that I know. So I guess that's why I picked it, because I'm a harmony guy, and this has the most beautiful harmony I've ever heard.
So introduce us to it.
Okay, so this is the second act ballad. This is from Annie Get Your Gun, written when he was already 58 years old. Okay, Annie Get Your Gun. People thought he was washed up. This was a kind of modern book musical that he wasn't even interested in. He liked to write these reviews. He wasn't interested in these modern book musicals. But at the age of 58, he wrote his greatest book musical. So this is Act Two, the wonderful ballad. Now, we've been introduced to her as this kind of wisecracking sharpshooter in the first act, but all of a sudden, this song gives us a completely different side to her character, an unbelievably vulnerable side, and it starts with the very first note. Here's the first eight bars of the introduction. So she sings, "Don't ask me just how it happened. I wish I knew. I can't believe that it happened. And still it's true." Now, the subtleties begin with the very opening chord, which already immediately shows Annie up in the air and confused. This is not a traditional firmly rooted chord. You have to listen closely. Not a firmly rooted chord, what musicians call a root position chord. That's not Annie, who was in Act One, who knew she was. But it's an up in the air, weightless, vulnerable chord. Hear the difference?
Yeah, I do.
Normal, up in the air.
Yeah, it leaves you feeling a little uncertain.
Exactly, from the very first chord. Now, the harmony is beautifully subtle here. He could easily have just written one chord for the entire first measure like this. Chord, don't ask me. But listen to how the extra dissonant chord on the word ask, don't ask me, makes the chord on just sound even sweeter. Just. That gorgeous chord. Just how it happened. One more time. Don't dissonant, sweet. If you don't love that chord, you'll never love Irving Berlin, and don't come to our program. Just how it happened. But that chord lets us know how what happened felt. That's what it felt like. Now, I wish I knew could easily have been this. And listen to just one chord on new. I wish I knew. Now, that would have been fine. I wish I knew. But listen to the wonderful dissonance and the accompaniment on new as she tries to figure out what happened. Not this, I wish I knew, but this, I wish I knew.
So Rob,
and
it's like, yeah, it's like she, like, I think a lot of people know what it feels like when you both fall in love, but it makes you feel flustered and unsettled. And you
exactly.
Just showed me all of that in like five notes.
And those four notes are her I'm flustered. What is it? I'm trying to figure it out. Now, those four notes didn't need to be there. You know, great composers don't really set words to music. What they set is the emotion behind the words. And it's the feeling of, I can't figure it out. Now, this is really subtle. The instruments could have just doubled the voice part like this with one line on, I can't believe that it happened. Get that in your ear, just one line of melody in the accompaniment. But he adds a second lower part, making this lovely duet. Not this, but this.
Yeah.
And now this is perfect. The verse could have ended thoughtfully down low like this. And still it's true. That would have been fine, ending down low. One more time. And still it's true. But instead, she floats up exquisitely like this. And still it's true. I mean, that is just exquisite floating up there. I mean, that is such a completely different Annie than we've met. And, you know, that's what's so great about this is discovering different sides of the character that even she herself was unaware of. Now, the power of harmony. Now we get to the famous chorus. Now, if I were to play you just the melody of this chorus by itself, you would never guess how moving it is. In fact, it's so ridiculously simple that it's almost embarrassing. The entire melody is just a single note repeated 10 times, and then we move up a step. Now, this is not great. I got lost in his arms, and I had to stay. I
mean, almost embarrassing.
That is embarrassing. I mean, and if that's not bad enough, he then does the same thing starting one note higher, the same note 10 times and then up like this. It was dark in his arms and I lost my way. And then you can't believe it, but he does it a third time, a step higher, the same note 10 times and then up a step. From the dark came a voice and it seemed to say. I mean, it doesn't get worse than this.
No, it kind of sounds like plink, 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 plink.
I mean, this is something that if you can't read music and you got one finger and you can't really play the piano well, you sit there and you go. I mean.
Yes. It sounds like an elementary school piano lesson.
Like elementary school. I mean, this is not great. But when you put the harmony underneath it, it becomes so incredibly exquisite and full of feeling. So you take this simple melody. But now when I put chords underneath, it becomes this. I got lost in his arms and I had to stay. I mean, everything about that is fantastic. A normal beginning for this would have been this. I got lost. But that doesn't show us what being lost feels like.
Yeah.
This is just words. I got lost. There's nothing wrong with it, but it tells us nothing more than the words themselves. But listen to the chords under it that shows us what being lost feels like. I got lost. That's what lost feels like. Lost in his arms. And I had to stay. And that rises up a little. And then listen to the second version. Again, the melody is just, it was dark in his arms. But the dissonance shows us what being dark in his arms feels like. It was dark, that chord.
Yeah, it's a dark chord.
It is so dark, dark in his arms. Now she lost her way, and I lost my way. That chord is what being lost feels like. The third version is the most exquisite of all. From the dark. Ooh, that fantastic chord. Dark came a voice, and it seemed to say. And then after this incredibly simple, slowly rising scale, describing how she felt, the punchline quotes the voice in the dark, and it says, there you go. It's an incredible release, and it's got a brand new melody. There you go. Wow, there you go. Now, again, chords could have been normal and told us nothing more. There you go. I mean, that would have been fine if a student handed it in. No problem. There you go. But there's no sense of release. Listen to the beautiful extra inner line in the accompaniment. There you go.
Yeah. Yeah.
Each one tells us where she's gone.
Yeah.
Here, here, here. And then the second one, she says the same word twice, but that's an opportunity to take us deeper inside what it means to her. The second time starts with this wistful chord. There you go. And then there's this, but there's also this. I mean, so fantastic.
Yeah. So, Rob, I feel like I'm on a journey where I understand what it means for her to fall in love.
Absolutely. And she's on the same journey. You know, the reason we listen to these great American songbook songs, really, is because they're ultimately about transformation. In a great theater song, the character is never the same person at the end of the song that they were at the beginning of the song. And for us, it's a model of transformation. It gives us hope that we too might someday be different people at the end of our songs than we were at the beginning of the songs. And that's what's so beautiful about the ending of this song, because we can cut to that. So like many Irving Berlin songs, repetition is the key to intelligibility, making sure people get it and can whistle on the way out of the theater. So it starts to repeat. How I felt as I fell, I just can't recall, but his arms held me fast and it broke the fall, all the same. But instead of continuing like the first time, and I said to my heart as it jumped around, that would copy the first time. The emotion pours forth in an extra tumble of notes on the words jumping all around. And I said to my heart as it, now we change, foolishly kept jumping all around.
And there it is, fluttering away.
Perfect. And the ending is perfect. We come back to the lost in his arms note. But she's discovered something else. He could have finished on that note. I got lost, but look what I've found. But there would be no transformation.
No, right.
She'd still be stuck on the same note. She would have discovered nothing. Instead, she magically rises, transformed to show us what she's found. I got lost, but look what I've dissonant and found.
And now I can float away with happiness.
That's it. I mean, transformation in a 32-measure song. I mean, that's what this music is all about.
Yeah. So before we let you go, I do want to have you do one other thing. Back in 2019, it's Irving Berlin. He wrote White Christmas. And back in 2019, you completely changed the way I understood that song. And at the beginning of this conversation, when you were talking about anti-Semitism, you made reference to the fact that it was his experience as a Jewish composer that took us to the greatness of White Christmas. So maybe give us like 3 minutes just for everybody to enjoy what we know you can do in teaching us the greatness of that song.
So, White Christmas. Here's the famous opening that everyone knows. I'm dreaming of a white Christmas. Just like the ones I used to know. Now, every single measure is special and has some incredible musical detail that helps bring this truly imaginary scene to life. You know, one of the things that I hope people get from all of these What Makes It Great programs is that the difference between good and great is both enormous and infinitesimal.
Yeah.
It's hundreds of small, inspired choices made by a composer, note by note, rhythm by rhythm, and measure by measure. So here's an ordinary version I wrote that gets rid of all the great details of the first four measures. I'm dreaming of a white Christmas. Now, that's actually closer to him than you actually think. But every single measure has something special. First of all, instead of this first neutral chord, which tells us nothing about what our feeling about Christmas is, he adds just one note, not this, but this.
And there's a warmth to that.
There's a warmth before we start. And again, it's just I'm is the word. Again, composers don't set words. They set the feeling behind the words. So this is ordinary. This is Berlin. I. Now, instead of this, we get this. Fantastic note.
Yeah.
It's like rubbing a hand on a foggy window. Ooh. And then not this, but add one note for warmth. Again, it's just one note. Ordinary Berlin. And then again, not this for Christmas, but another rubbing the hand on the foggy window. Ordinary Berlin.
I mean, I can feel the warmth of the fire. I can smell the pine tree. I feel longing for family. And you played like three notes.
Exactly. And it just continues. Every single thing. Again, here's the next phrase. Ordinary. Just like the ones I know. Boring. You get nothing. Just like the ones I know. But instead, he reaches just one note higher. Like this. Just like the ones, all the yearning in that one note, ones I used to know. Now, how do you make the treetops glisten? Well, here's how you don't do it. Where the treetops glisten. Again, there's nothing there, but listen to the descending line in Berlin's piano part and the aching chord on glisten.
where the tree tops glisten.
I mean, harmony is the best invention man has ever come up with. Glisten, and then the voice copies treetops glisten, lower for children listen. And ordinary harmony in the piano, again, would have been no emotion whatsoever. And children listen, who cares? But he adds this beautiful descending line in the piano and a remarkable dissonant chord on listen, filled with unexpected pain. You know, Berlina actually had his second child die on Christmas Day. And Christmas Day was always a poignant day for him. He would visit the cemetery on Christmas Day every year of his second child. So we feel that in under and children on the chord and listen, listen. So much poignancy there. And listen to how the piano part depicts the sound of the sleigh bells in the snow at the end of the next phrase. To hear sleigh bells in the snow. And here they go.
Here they go.
Bells, 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 ding, 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 ding. I mean, it's just fantastic.
So that's just the beginning of what also makes White Christmas great. And we are going to post that. If people want to hear the whole conversation with you from 2019, which made me fall in love with Irving Berlin in a new way, but kind of with you in a new way too, Rob, we will link to that on our website at radioboston.org. So, Rob, ultimately, Irving Berlin, harmony. At the beginning, you said what you've always loved is harmony. And this is a man, if I understand from you, whose trials in life, his struggles to be who he wanted to be, and to learn what he didn't even know how to do, created a kind of depth of harmony in him that is what makes his music so great.
Yeah, I think it's also his depth of experience as a human being. You know, he constantly talked about wanting to reach the average man, that his vernacular of the middle class was the language that he was looking for. He didn't want hoity-toityness. He wanted to get the heart of America. But I think what he really wanted to talk about was getting at what was universal. It wasn't even so much middle America versus elite America. It was what was universal. I think that's what allowed him as an immigrant Jew to actually write something like A White Christmas, because he was looking beyond the religious significance of the holiday, which I suppose is easier to do as an outsider, but looking for what was fundamentally American about it. I think his experience as an outsider made him look for what was universal, what was the universal human experience, and his own trials and tribulations, I think, deepened his sense of what was possible to write about.
Musician, composer, and author Rob Capello. He'll be in Boston this weekend for part one of the Celebrity Series of Boston, What Makes It Great, Inventing America series. And you can find a link for more information, including how to get tickets and how to watch the show virtually on our website, radioboston.org. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR. Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. On behalf of the whole Radio Boston team, thanks for listening. Join us again Monday for more Radio Boston.